You don't see the gamble until it starts wrecking you completely. I mean, you wake up one morning and look in the mirror and you don't see nothing. Because what you see, you don't want. Look like you done worked a million years when all you've been doing is using dope every day.
When all you've been doing is using dope every day. Yesterday, today, and tomorrow, a special recorded program of the NBC News and Special Events Department begins today the first of a series of three programs entitled The Truth About Narcotics. Malcolm Johnson, noted International News Service reporter, Pulitzer Prize winner for his work in uncovering crime conditions, has made a survey of the drug traffic. Here he is to present his findings. Malcolm Johnson.
What is the truth about narcotics? Where do the illicit drugs come from? Why has there been such a sharp increase in drug addiction? But first, how much of an epidemic do we have?
There's no way in the world for you to exaggerate. But it's known all over Chicago that 6 out of every 10 children in our high schools are on some kind of narcotic.
That's the view of a civic leader on Chicago's teeming South Side. One of the country's top criminologists, Austin McCormick of the University of California, takes a somewhat calmer view.
I happen to be one of those who believe that the increase has been considerably exaggerated, or at least that we don't know exactly how many we have and that we're in grave danger of guessing among the thousands and finding later that the figure is nowhere near that high.
And here's Dr. Victor Vogel, head of the government's narcotics hospital at Lexington, Kentucky.
This epidemic seems to be so far raging in large cities, particularly New York, Chicago, and to a lesser extent, Washington. There's a peculiar discrepancy, and not altogether clear to me as to why it should be, between the fact that we have always been able to take first-time male applicants at Lexington and the press reports of thousands and thousands of teenagers in New York and Chicago particularly who need treatment but unable to get it.
We turn to another man who knows the picture, Richard Moser, who succeeded Rudolph Halley as chief counsel for the Senate Crime Committee. How about it, Mr. Moser?
It appears that there is probably some exaggeration on this subject on the part of people who are interested in publicity. They tend to exaggerate it. On the other hand, the enforcement officials throughout the country seem to me to be underestimating the amount of increase. The truth probably lies somewhere in between.
So there is an epidemic, in spots at least. Here is the questioning of an addict with a history. He's 25 years old, a musician, a composer, an arranger with a bright future, all behind her, because she couldn't live on her income of $250 a week. She needed more than $200 a week for drugs, and as they always do, she turned to theft and prostitution. She's from Brockton, Massachusetts, a graduate of a college famous for its music training, schooled in the New England Conservatory. She's an attractive blonde girl with a soft voice and a great sympathy for her fellow addicts.
Tell us something about some of those drugstores that are freely selling needles and other things.
On 117th and Lenox, you go in and you can ask the man for needles, and if he thinks you look all right, he'll just fish them from underneath the counter and give them to you, no questions asked. Regular needles are 23, 25 cents. They charge 50 cents for them.
And you think they know what you're going to use them for?
Oh, definitely they do. On 125th Street and 133rd in Lenox and 117th in Lenox, they have the pacifier dropper and the elastic all fixed.
It's all ready. Yes. With the elastic band on it and everything. Yes. And do they ask you if you want it?
Yes. When you ask for the needle, they'll say, do you want the works too?
What do you think of the statement that only 154 school children are using drugs?
No, that's definitely not true. I know over that amount myself, and it's got worse than last year. There seems to be more young children using it, and unfortunately, I've sold myself to young children. I know for a fact.
How old were they?
17, 18 years old.
You know any younger than that who are using it?
Yes, No girls 12 and 13 years old smoking marijuana, taking benzodrine, smoking hashish, opium, sniffing heroin and cocaine. And, 154 is just an understatement. As you said, it might be in one school that there are 154 children using it. But in one neighborhood, maybe, but there's definitely thousands of them in New York City. I know a couple of hundred myself.
And it's brought out a whole new lexicon. Mainlining, skin popping, speed balls and hot shots, pusher and caps and horse for heroin. Here's a United States senator questioning an addict in this strange new language.
Did you sniff it first before? Sir. Did you do any, use it skin popping too?
Yes, sir.
After that?
Yes.
And did you later on use it mainlining?
Yes.
Into the veins?
That's right.
Drug addiction is an infectious disease. You can't confine it to a slum district and forget it. But it is basically and primarily a phenomenon of the underprivileged. Mr. Moser?
I think it's quite clear that there is a relation between slums and addiction. We find a good many addicts among well-to-do people, but they are usually psychological cases who would probably run into some difficulty anyway. On the other hand, in the slum areas, where the young people have very inadequate forms of entertainment and recreation, they're much more likely to come across drugs and people who are using drugs. And when they associate with people of that kind, they become tempted to use them themselves.
This Brooklyn bookie is a tough guy at the age of 16. An agent from the Attorney General's office questions him.
You tell me the story in your own words.
You ask me a question, I'll tell you. Well, I'll answer it directly.
Did you ever see narcotics being sold in this school?
I did.
And by how many persons?
One salesman.
And what type of narcotics did he sell?
He sold everything. Marijuana, cocaine, and heroin. Well, I know how much he grossed in, as far as I know. $300 to $400 daily.
He grossed $300 to $400 daily.
That's
in this
right.
school? How did you know that?
I used to be a bookie in a school. And
did it ever occur to you that he might be exaggerating to build himself up?
No.
Did you think that he was telling the truth when he told you that he
lost a lot enough lost enough money to me, so he should be telling the truth.
How much you say he lost to you?
Well, that's my business.
Later, the boy bookie of Brooklyn started on narcotics himself, using up the profits from his bookie business. All this right in school. Where in school? Sometime right in the classroom. This 16-year-old Manhattan youngster tells how.
Where did you get the money to pay for the marijuana?
I work for it.
What kind of work do you do?
I sweep the factory.
This is after school?
Yes.
And how much money do you make?
$12.
Now, were some of these times you meet these friends in school?
Yes.
And would they give you the heroin in school?
Upstairs in my classroom.
Where in the classroom?
In the back of the room.
How many boys would be with you when you used to pass heroin back and forth?
Inside of school?
In about, the classroom?
Yes, about five.
About five. Would you all go back to the back of the class?
Yes.
And would you all sniff heroin?
No, one by one.
Those are the voices of the underprivileged, and they tell Malcolm Johnson an unvarying story of how they started.
They begin on marijuana, a girl from Baltimore.
I guess I had smoked marijuana for about a year when I started using heroin.
Or this woman from Washington.
At first I was smoking marijuana, and then I changed to heroin.
This girl began with a reefer, then went on to shoplifting and jail.
I started with marijuana and then switched to heroin. I was 18.
That's the critical age, 18. A few sticks of marijuana and then H or horse, the addict's term for heroin. Heroin, the German trade name for diamorphine. So deadly dangerous it's outlawed in this country for any purpose. When it was first developed, they believed it was safer than morphine because the doctors thought it was not habit-forming. Now again, the best sources say that marijuana technically isn't habit-forming. Here's an expert's explanation on that score.
There are two phases to addiction. One is physical and one is mental. Now, it's true that marijuana is not a drug that causes physical addiction. A person can smoke it for weeks, stop it, and not have any drugs and have no ill effects. But by the same token, his smoking that has changed his psychic state to such an extent that he wants to continue taking something that will change him and give him a boost or a lift. We call that habituation.
That doctor is an expert on narcotics. He's an addict himself. He knows the deep psychological wounds caused by addiction. The addict longs for drugs. At the same time, he has another hope.
There's no drug addict that's ever got a habit, see? There's nobody ever hooked on drugs that ain't thinking about how he can get off.
Caught in that dilemma, he shows a pathological reluctance to swear off. Here's an intelligent man, a doctor from Philadelphia.
I'm a physician. I've been here since December 20th, 1948. Well, I'd never taken any morphine, any narcotics, until I'd been in the hospital and had an operation. Uh-huh. Of course, that's the usual story, but unfortunately, it happens to be true. And when I came out, I was very nicely addicted. I'm leaving in 3 weeks. I'm going back into practice. I leave here with the feeling that I don't want to take any more, yes, and with the feeling that I don't intend to take it, if it's at all possible. I don't think there's anybody that can say that he'll never touch it. I hope I won't jump in and take it again this next, if there should be another time.
Peggy has been in for the cure more than 100 times. Tell me, Peggy, will you go back to the needle?
Mister, I tell you exactly how I feel about it. This is not my first trip here. It isn't my first trip in any institution. It's my 135th altogether. I can say this, that knowing drugs as I do, that it weakens your willpower the longer you're on it. And I cannot tell you the truth or anybody else and make a promise that I won't go back on drugs.
Helen is 56, and she's been through the tortures of withdrawal from drugs many times. But she's no more confident about the future than Peggy. Helen, will you ever go back on drugs?
Well, I hope not. I don't know as I can promise anybody anything. If I don't get sick again, I'll probably stay off a long time.
These are patients at the Lexington Hospital. It's no wonder that Dr. Vogel says...
The very heart of the institution is the psychiatric staff. And the program of psychiatric and medical and surgical attention for the patients. We've got to help the man understand why he wanted to take drugs. Why he may be tempted to take them again after he leaves. Sometimes solving this is accomplished by medical treatment or surgical operation, but in most cases, it depends on helping the man to an understanding of some emotional or psychiatric difficulty.
Then, is there any foolproof treatment for the addict? We put the question to Dr. Nathan Eddy, a narcotics specialist and advisor to the World Health Organization. Is there a sure cure, doctor?
I don't think I can answer that question. In some individuals, it is curable, I suppose. In some individuals, I doubt very much if it is curable. It's a psychiatric problem, I think.
And this psychiatric problem complicates hospital treatment. Dr. Vogel tells how.
They're likely to go out against advice at two periods of the treatment. One during the first 10 days or 2 weeks when they're uncomfortable because they're being withdrawn. They have a very vivid picture of how the medicine that they might be able to get on the outside will make them well again and comfortable, at least temporarily. There's a second period of danger for the voluntary patient. After he's been here 2 months or so, he's gained a lot of weight, he begins to feel fine. He feels that, after all, addiction is just a state of mind, and my mind is right now. I'm anxious to go out and prove to my family that I've been neglecting so long that I can now assume my responsibilities, begin to make some money and pay up my back debts. I want to get out and prove that I'm cured. Now, his judgment at that time is not valid. We have a follow-up research study here. Each year, we try and find out what happens to our patients who were discharged during the previous 5-year period. We find that approximately 22% of all our patients discharged 1 to 5 years previously are still off drugs. we find that about the same percentage, 22%, are known to have relapsed to drugs. That leaves about 50% which we are unable to trace at all. Now, that necessarily isn't bad, because the cured case, perhaps as much as the uncured case, may wish to keep his past a secret and not reveal it. We believe, because of vigorous enforcement of the Harrison Narcotic Act, that it's impossible for many people to remain addicted for long periods of time without coming to the attention of the law enforcement officers. So if 50% of our discharge cases have not come to the attention of law enforcement officers during the five-year period after discharge, we feel that a pretty good proportion, perhaps as many as half, are still off drugs, even though we can't trace them.
That's the case for hospitalization. A high percentage of relapses, but a good many five-year cures. We asked Dr. Eddy about the criminal tendencies of the addict.
Drugs don't make criminals. They're already criminals. The drug may make it easier for them to commit the criminal act, but the criminal tendency was there to start with. At least that's my opinion.
This Cincinnati showgirl disagrees.
I know that when I first started using heroin that I had no idea that it would make a slave out of me or it would make me commit the crimes that I have.
The cost of your daily amount that you took daily at its peak, did you give that?
Yes.
How much was it?
I'd say I have it ranged anyplace from $30 to $80 a day. Of course, when you're on speedball, that's cocaine and heroin, there is no particular amount that you require any day because your system always wants it. As much money as you can get, that's as much money as you'll use to shoot in you.
You do anything to get the money?
Yes, anything. When you want drugs, you'll get the money one way or another.
They get the money one way or another, and they will not tell where they get the drugs. Here's Senator Wiley trying to pry information from a witness, a friendly witness, willing and apparently honestly trying to be helpful, but not on that score.
Why is it you hesitate? Like in the mafia, they hesitate. Tell the names of those who commit murder. Why do you hesitate to give us the names? The places where this poison is gotten in this fair city of Washington.
You're absolutely right, Senator. I think that any drug peddler that's caught you would have a heavy sentence imposed on him.
What's the name of the last guy that sold you that stuff?
Well, Senator, to tell you the honest truth, I don't remember.
All right. What's the last place you went in Washington to get that stuff?
I don't even remember that, sir.
No. Well, now, let's call it the last place. Can you remember within 6 months before you came to jail, any place in Washington, any peddler's name, where you got that stuff?
No, I can't.
I can't
remember a thing.
No.
The addict, with reservations about quitting for good, doesn't want to close any avenues of supply. But there may be a more sinister reason for his reluctance to tell. He's at the mercy of the pusher who sells to him. Our Cincinnati showgirl explains the hot shot.
A hot shot contains poison. It's sold under the pretense that it's drugs. It's usually given to a person because they have informed on somebody else.
Do you know of any instances where persons have died from
the
use of?
But that's murder. It ceases to be a matter of mental illness and capsule peddling. It becomes cold-blooded murder. Here again is Malcolm Johnson.
The demand is there. The addict will get the money one way or another. The seller holds a threat of death over his victims, and the situation is ready-made for the racketeer.
We find that there's been quite a sharp increase in the importation of heroin from Italy. This seems to be, although we haven't been able to prove it yet, attributable to a ring of narcotic smugglers who are bringing it in from Italy. There's a good deal of evidence indicating that the head of that ring is Luciano. The evidence that he has given himself indicates that he has no source of livelihood, and yet he seems to get along all right and be able to live well and bet on the horses. He says that he's been living principally on money that's been sent to him by friends from this country, mostly in small amounts. The probability is that he receives rather substantial amounts from this country for the heroin that he arranges to have shipped over here.
Currently, Italy is the number one source. Luciano, paroled by Governor Dewey in 1946 and deported to Italy, is the kingpin. How does Richard Moser know this? Narcotics agent Charles Saragusa has combed Luciano's hangouts abroad. Here he reports to Moser and the Senate committee.
In this interrogation statement here made by Lucky, he made certain explanations about his mode of living and how where he got his money from. I'm reading, I'll translate from the Italian portions. In addition to $22,500, which I declared to the Italian police as having brought with me into Italy from America.
This is Luciano speaking.
This is Luciano speaking.
Yes, go ahead.
I have received other sums of money from America. I have received from America two or three times certain sums of money, approximately a few thousand dollars. I say that this money was brought to me in Italy regularly, and it was given to me, these monies were given to me as gifts by old friends from the United States. All of the money which I have brought to Italy and that which I have received subsequently from my friends in America, I have spent. About 500,000 lira a month I spent, which comes from the United States.
Now, let's see who some of his friends are. Let me first ask you about Nicola Gentili.
Nicola Gentili is a gangster from New York City. Very notorious rackets.
Has he had any connection with narcotics, as far as you know?
Yes, sir. He was under indictment. I'm pretty certain it was a narcotic indictment in New York City when he fled to Italy.
Does he mention a man named Joe Picci?
Yes, he does.
P-I-C-I is Picci.
Yes, sir.
Tell us about Joe Picci. Who's he?
Well, Joe Picci is Lucky Luciano's narcotic lieutenant for Italy. And he's now a co-defendant in this narcotic investigation which was conducted by the Italian authorities.
Did Picci ever live in the United States?
Yes, sir. He lived in the United States and he was deported.
For what charge?
On a white slave, after a white slave conviction.
Now, you have made some investigation of Peachy's activities, as I understand it. Where do they think he is now?
Well, I searched all over northern and southern Italy for him, and he eluded our capture. My opinion is that possibly he's come back into the United States.
Is there any suspicion that he smuggled himself in and brought any heroin with him?
Not at the present time. I have no information to that effect, but I do know that several years ago we had reason to believe that he did smuggle himself back into the United States with a quantity of drugs. We heard that he took 15 kilos of heroin to the Kansas City mafia mob.
And how many kilos do they think that Peachy brought in with him?
15 kilos.
What's kilo cost in Italy?
In Italy, when I was there, the clandestine price ranged from 1,000 to 1,500 American dollars for a kilo.
How much does a kilo usually sell for in this country?
Well, when the kilo's first brought into New York City, it may get as high as $6,000 wholesale price.
And out of a kilo, they could make a million pills or doses.
I'd say about a million capsules.
Making that into a million capsules, $2 a piece, would make about $2 million for an original investment, $1,500 to $1,000.
Yes, the profit's tremendous.
And then you said that this is a typical mafia case.
Narcotics, we believe, is the most profitable venture.
You mean that narcotic distribution and smuggling is the principal source of income of the mafia, is that correct?
Yes, sir.
Now, you've given us a pretty clear-cut factual statement showing Luciano's connection in Italy with the trade in this country. Have you any information to tell us whether or not Luciano has the power to enforce his connections here through threatening or coercion or through gunmen or any other method.
From what I have seen, and I have spoken to some members of his gang there in an undercover capacity, I would say he, if he's not the king, then he's one of the royal family, and the fact that he receives these large sums of money from these American gangsters indicates to me that he has a definite weight in policy matters, and that he is still deriving an income from American rackets.
Italy is the active source. There's an even bigger potential illicit supply in a land where they've been plagued with the poppy juice for 1,200 years, China. The Chinese Reds have placed on the world market 500 tons of opium. Narcotics Commissioner Harry Anslinger cites a case.
On February 15th, Japanese narcotic agent seized 40 pounds of heroin in Kobe, which came from Tianjin, and arrested four Japanese communist leaders for possession of heroin. Four of the 19 packages seized bore the labels of the Druo Well Pharmaceutical Laboratory, Lux Street, Tianjin, China. We have photographs of the labels, and they're genuine. This heroin was allegedly smuggled into Japan aboard a British aircraft carrier from Hong Kong. The Japanese authorities report that previous large seizures of heroin in Japan have originated from these factories, and there is evidence that some of this heroin is finding its way into the United States and other countries by way of Japan.
It's a complex problem. There's no simple solution, and Mr. Moser appreciates the complexity, appreciates the difference between the helpless addict victim and the venal racketeer who preys on him.
We find that there are really two types of what they call peddlers. About 50% of the small peddlers themselves are addicts. The one who's the addict is usually to be sympathized with. He's pathetic. He's a man who is selling the drug for the purpose of getting enough money to support his own habit. He wishes he didn't have to do it. He wishes he weren't an addict. He knows it's wrong and would like to avoid it. The gangster type of dealer, on the other hand, is almost never an addict himself. In a ring that we found containing 8 or 10 men dealing in deals of from $10,000 to $25,000 a piece, we found that there was only one addict in the whole group, and he was sort of a minor member of the partnership, and he was used as a tester. The other dealers, in order to ascertain the quality of the heroin that they were selling, would have to have somebody to try it out on, and that was his job, to try it. And he also sold the heroin as well. The gangster type of dealer is the worst type of criminal that this country could have.
You have been listening to Yesterday, Today, and Tomorrow, a transcribed feature of the NBC News and Special Events Department. Today, we presented Malcolm Johnson, Pulitzer Prize-winning crime reporter for the International News Service, in the first of three programs on the truth about narcotics. Next week, a case study, the truth about barbiturates. A doctor tells the story of his own addiction. We wish to thank the UN Commission on Narcotics, the Senate Crime Investigating Committee, the Office of New York State Attorney General Nathaniel Goldstein, Len O'Connor of NBC Chicago office, stations WTIC Hartford, WBAL Baltimore, and other NBC-affiliated stations for the cooperation which makes this documentary possible. This is Kenneth Banghart speaking.
Tonight, it's Martin Kane, Private Eye, on NBC.